Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Today's guest is Sheila Jeffries. She is a lesbian feminist scholar and political activist and professor in political science at the University of Melbourne in Australia. She's the author of more than 10 books. Today we'll be talking about her books Beauty and Misogyny and The Industrial Vagina. So thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure.
So my first question, well, I want to ask a question and then do a quote from Beauty and Misogyny, and then ask you to both go after the question and the quote. And the first question is, so what is the relationship between beauty and misogyny? And the quote is, I am arguing here that ideologies of beauty and fashion, such as those circulated through popular culture, subordinate women. However passionately those women may adhere to them and cut up their bodies in response. Indeed, as Denise Thompson says, passionate enthusiasm is the way ideology must operate if it is to operate at all. Thompson suggests that the only criterion for judging whether something is ideological is whether or not it reinforces relations of ruling. The test of whether or not they reinforce relations of ruling is a useful one to apply to the beauty practices such as makeup, fashion, and labiaplasty that are examined in this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's quite a bit there, it's fair to say. But the last part of that, which is why do beauty practices and notions of beauty create a hierarchy and subordinate women? Well, the whole book is about the ways in which they do this, of course. But often people say, well, what's the problem with beauty practices? You know, women can choose to wear makeup and so on. And the first thing I always say is, well, if these beauty practices are so terrific and if they're just about choice, why are men not enthusiastically wearing lipstick and wearing high-heeled shoes? They're not doing that. So we understand that the practices are gendered. We understand as well that gender is a hierarchy, men being gendered as masculine means that they're in a higher sex caste, a superior sex caste, and they do not have to engage in these practices. Whereas women have to engage in these practices in order, first of all, to show that they are members of the subordinate class. You can't create a system of hierarchy between the sexes unless you know who is in each one. And therefore, as I say in my book, a man in 1935, psychologist on the psychology of clothes, said the important thing was that a man needed to know that a woman was approaching him. He would hear her heels on the pavement, and even if he couldn't see her, he'd know what it was. His penis would start to rise, and he'd start to get sexual satisfaction. So men need to know who is female in order to know who is in that sex class. Women, therefore, have to be identified by the practices they put on their body. It identifies them as female. But those practices also give men enormous sexual satisfaction to the extent that men are actually excited and created into being masculine possessors of sexual excitement by women's subordination, and their subordination is constructed through those practices.
So As you're saying this, I'm thinking of something that I heard just this last week. I was watching a baseball game, and one of the announcers said that one of the players, oh, he's a really good-looking shortstop. And what he meant by that is the person has the shortstop, the player, had the right build and right movement for being a shortstop. So good-looking in this case meant that the player was going to be good at his purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately was thinking about how if someone will say, if a man will say, oh, she's a good-looking woman, they're not meaning that she's, that doesn't mean that she's, you know, good at basketball or good at something else. It has a very specific sexual reference. And so it was just very interesting to me that when they talk about a good-looking baseball player, it's functional. And when they talk about a good-looking woman, then presumably that means that's also functional, right? In terms of the function of the woman would be to be the sex object. Is that right?
Yes, that is the main function of women under male supremacy, to be a sex object. That's right. So the practices of beauty, I argue in the book, that women are expected to do upon themselves today, like makeup and high-heeled shoes and revealing clothing and so on, come historically from or are very associated with the sex industry, which of course is about making women sexually available to men. Lipstick, for instance, there's a fascinating book by sexologists which says that makeup comes from Ur of the Chaldees, Babylon, and was used by women in prostitution to show that they would do oral sex. So the lipstick makes their lips look like engorged labia. And so, of course, I say when I'm teaching this and teaching to my students, why would you wish to walk down the streets of your city saying, I would like to do oral sex on men? It's a kind of extraordinary situation. The high-heeled shoes, for instance, it seems, and I suggest in the book, in the West particularly, I know they've been used at other points in history, but in the 19th century they seem to have come from brothels in America. The binding of feet in China came from concubines dancing in pain, as ballet comes from, of course, women dancing in pain, which gives satisfaction to their sexual superiors and overseers and so on. So the beauty practices are very much about making women into sexual objects that will give men sexual satisfaction. And in the book I say that when women, for instance, wear high-heeled shoes, they are doing two things at the same time. They are both complimenting men with an E in the middle of the word, which means they're saying, we are female and subordinate members of the female sex class, which makes you masculine and superior. So they're paying a compliment, they're actually being a compliment in that way to men, sort of the opposite and adding on. They are also making a compliment to men with an I by saying, we're acknowledging you are members of the sex class. The sex class male, we're paying that compliment, and we are saying, you know, we are prepared to be deferential, because I also argue that these practices that women are supposed to do don't just make them apparently different from men, but they're also practices of deference. They're showing their deference to men, their obedience, their desire to be men's sexual objects.
Well, I agree with you, and can you make really clear to listeners the not just that it's differentiation, but also subordination?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you want me to make that clearer, did you say?
Yeah. I completely agree with you, but I'm wondering if you can make that point even clearer for listeners, that it's not merely differentiation, but also subordination. How does? I know you've sort of said this, but can you say it even more clearly? That how does wearing lipstick or makeup, how does that imply specifically subordination?
Yeah, the practices that women do, I argue in the book, as beauty practices, are practices of subordination. Not only because they show women are separate and different. But also the practices are practices that members of the superior sex class wouldn't consider, because they are painful, they are harmful, they have a bad effect on the way in which women can think about themselves. The sorts of things that other feminists, and not just myself, say about these practices, for instance, is that for a woman to constantly have to be checking herself in order to make sure during the whole of every day that she might be seen by men, that she's being attractive to them, has an impact upon the sense of self. It makes the woman into an object for herself. She sees herself as an object, is constantly checking herself. And the studies show, for instance, that women very often look in mirrors during the day in their workplace or wherever they are to check that they are looking right. This is something that men don't have to do. As I argue in the book, men can in the morning just run out of the house in flat shoes, wearing loose clothing, jangling their keys in their pockets and whistle down the street. Women have to have very carefully spent usually about 20 minutes of every day, the studies suggest, but if they're going out in the evening it could run to 45 minutes, transforming themselves. They have to remove the hair from their bodies. Presently, they even have to remove the hair from their genitals presently, because the fashion at the moment is that they should do that as a result of pornography, which is one aspect of the sex industry. They have to do all kinds of things to their makeup and their hair and their appearance. And it's very troubling in terms of the way that they're able to think about themselves, the way that they're able to engage in life. And I do often laugh with my students and say, if you think of 20 minutes a day over the sort of lifetime of a woman, it adds up to about at least 3 years. And she could, in that time, do something useful, like learn Korean, which would be a fascinating thing to do, but she's not in a position to do that. Obviously, it takes an enormous amount of money, too. And it's extremely disturbing in terms of the way that a woman relates to the world. I can remember talking to a splendid woman in her 60s who'd been active in feminism, a heterosexual woman, and she was saying to me that she had only recently started wearing lipstick because she had become invisible. And I sat there and I said to her, you're not invisible to me, and you never were. So who do you mean invisible to? Well, what she meant was that in the world, nobody took any notice of her, and particularly men didn't take any notice of her, and no longer noticed that she existed because she wasn't doing the sexual corvée, as I call it in the book. So women have this terrible dilemma that they have constantly to be attracting men's notice because they don't exist in their own right. I mean, for me, it was wonderful to be able to give up beauty practices when I became a feminist in my 20s, and I have never considered myself invisible in the world, but this is a terrible burden that is placed upon women. If we think about beauty practices such as high-heeled shoes, they are enormously painful. And I think everybody's pretty aware of this. And yet it's just somehow, when I talk to my students about it, they accept that when they're 13, 14 years old, they're supposed to learn to be able to be good at wearing high-heeled shoes and even supposedly run in them. And this is some kind of skill that they're expected to be able to mistress, whereas young males do not have to mistress a painful and crippling skill. They could learn to throw a ball or do other all sorts of useful things, but not learn how to make themselves capable of doing something crippling and in pain. So the practices are expensive, take an enormous amount of time, have an effect upon the way that a woman can think about herself and be in the world. They're painful. They're the practices required of subordinates to change them into persons who will be sexually attractive to members of the male sex caste. So it's not simply about difference.
And that's great. And a couple of things. One is, as you're talking about 20 minutes or 45 minutes a day, I was thinking about the fact that I'm lucky if I remember to comb my hair once a week, you know? So I probably spend, I mean, excluding, you know, basic hygiene like showering and stuff like that, I probably spend about 3 minutes a week attending to my actual appearance.
That's right.
And so that's one thing. Another thing is, I was pretty astounded, not just in terms of the whole, I completely agree with you with the subjugation, the deference, but in addition, okay, correct me if I've got the number wrong, but the average woman in her life consumes more than 4 kilograms of lipstick, is that correct?
I think that was the figure that I've used in the book that I found in the research, yes.
So just by putting it on their lips, and I mean, so also these beauty practices such as high heels, you know, that's obviously deformative, but in addition, they're consuming, I mean, they're putting all this petroleum-based products on their skin and consuming 4 kilograms of lipstick in their life.
Well, the makeup products that they're putting on their face and the things that they're using on their body will usually contain very large numbers of harmful chemicals, often hundreds of harmful chemicals they'll be placing on their skin, and of course that is absorbed through the skin. Hair dye, for instance, is black hair dye in particular is potentially carcinogenic and causes kidney cancer. So there's huge health implications of all of this. Certainly this is something that subordinates are prepared to, expected to cope with, not members of the superior caste.
So you also point out that many of the attitudes that we would perceive as stereotypically feminine can also be seen in, say, boss-employee relations, where a boss is allowed to take up more space and an employee, yeah. Oh, a boss is also allowed to touch an employee with impunity, but the impunity should never touch the boss. And there was one that really, okay, I'm forgetting it. What was the one that really blew me away? The, I'm sorry. There was...
Yeah, I'm happy to just describe what that's about. This is based on research that was done in the 1970s by Nancy Henley on body politics. And what she's explaining is that the body politics usually associated with femininity are in fact learnt as the behavior that subordinates can engage in. And so the body politics that women are supposed to engage in, for instance, are keeping their arms and legs together and making sure that they don't take up space. And when I describe this to students, I say, you know, you were on the bus or the tram this morning. When you see a man or a woman is coming towards you, you're pleased, aren't you, if it's a woman, because you know that there won't be knees digging into your thigh and you will actually have a little bit more space. It works on planes as well. Everybody knows what I mean, and even the men are happy if a woman comes towards them because they're going to get more space. So men sit with their knees apart, they spread, they put their arms wherever they like, they take up space. And the research shows that men have more personal space. That is, if other men come towards men or women come towards men, a greater area of personal space is left around the body. Children have very little personal space because they have no power. The way that that relates to power in offices and so on is that obviously the most powerful people have the largest offices, and you're not able to approach a person with power in the same way as a person without. It works with who you're allowed to touch as well, and as I usually say, that, you know, if you're going in for an interview, you do not rush up and sort of pat on the back the person who's going to interview you because they have power. You're very careful. You keep your distance. And then you keep your distance in the chair that you're sitting in for the interview. You don't sprawl. You're very careful because you're in a position of subordination. It works for eye language too. The powerful may look at the powerless, and the powerless may not look at the powerful in the same way. And I talk about, you know, if there's a pub and a man is apparently staring at another man, a man will say, "What are you staring at?" and may throw beer over them. Because it's recognized that that staring is about power, but women are expected to simply accept all that staring and that invasion of their space all of the time. So the practices that we understand to be feminine, I argue, are in fact the practices of deference and subordination. Women are supposed to simper, smile all the time. Smiling is a requirement of women to make men feel better, and men say, "What's the matter with you, darling? Why don't you smile in the street or whatever?" And women are forced to smile. They're forced to keep their arms and legs together. They're forced to be very careful whom they're touching. So these practices start very, very young, with little girls who are told to keep their legs together because, of course, little girls are still amazingly, even in 2013, expected to wear skirts. I know this is extraordinary to you and it is extraordinary to me because, of course, little girls should have the same human or children's rights as little boys and be able to climb trees, run about. They should wear the same comfortable, easy clothes, but they're not. It's like putting a veil on a child's head. It actually snuffs out part of their humanness and teaches them their subordinate status. So the girls are put into skirts. They then have to keep their knees together so that men who would be sexually excited are not able to look up those skirts and see their knickers. And they're transformed in the way that they're able to be human from a very early age.
So just to make it really clear, one of the things I hear you saying is that we should pay attention to many of the mannerisms and things we take for granted, and we should examine these behaviors in the light of power relations.
We should certainly do that. And in fact, I discovered on a website which was about training men who like to cross-dress and get sexually excited by imitating the subordinate behavior and clothing of women. There's a fascinating piece on one of these websites on training in femininity where these men were actually being instructed that they needed to keep their legs together because open was about power and closed was about no power. And so for those men who it's exciting to imitate the no power because they're masochists, they needed to know about open and closed in relation to legs in sitting. Now, I thought that was fascinating because those men who carefully study what is exciting and masochistically exciting about the so-called female behavior they want to imitate, they know what those positions mean, whereas probably the vast majority of women have never thought how the way that they hold themselves, their arms and legs and so on, is actually constructed in a system of power to create their lower caste status, whereas these men are able to identify it immediately.
I keep thinking, as you say all this, that about this line I read by Robert Coombs one time, which is, unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't question so much, but then often when we do question, I guess the next sort of direction I'd like to go with this is two things. One of them is that I know that reviews on Amazon and general comments on the internet in general are just a surefire way to make us lose all hope in any, you know, decency and humanity, because so many people make so many stupid comments on the internet. But one of the reviews of Beauty and Misogyny is by a woman who says, I didn't like this book because the truth is I love having the choice to wear high heels, and I love, it's my choice to do this and my choice to wear lipstick, and I love doing all this. And that takes me to another quote from your book. And so where I'd like for you to go with this, if you don't mind, is talking about the larger political, I don't really like the word zeitgeist, but we'll go with it because I can't think of a better one, of the 1970s that led to radical feminism, and then the backlash and the neoliberalism of personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this great line about, quote, by the 1990s, these ideas about the power of choice influenced the thinking of many feminists too. The idea that women were coerced into beauty practices by the fashion/beauty complex, for instance, was challenged by a new breed of liberal feminists who talked about women being empowered by the feminist movement to choose beauty practices that could no longer be seen as oppressive. So can you give a larger political backdrop to that backlash?
Yes. Back in the 1970s, when these beauty practices were being questioned by feminists, feminists were part of a series of very considerable movements of social change in the Western world, which included the Black Power movement, socialist movement, feminist movement. These were big, powerful movements. And part of all of those movements was an understanding of structural forces of power which constructed the way in which people were able to think and the ways in which they should be able to act. The unfortunate thing is that those very powerful movements for change are a long time ago now. In between, we had decades of neoliberalism created by Margaret Thatcher in Britain and Reagan in America and Milton Friedman and neoliberal economics and so on, which argued that, as Mrs. Thatcher said in Britain, there is no such thing as society, just the individual. And this rampant individualism, what was created, was of course created to sell products and to ensure that consumer capitalism continued so that people were able to consume in order to construct their identities, particular products and so on. That meant that the feminist understanding of the way in which women were able to think and be and behave, the way in which that was constructed by forces of power, became much less easy to understand. And the mantra of choice, which goes with neoliberalism, which is about how you should be able, parents should be able to choose the school for their children, which is an attack on state education and the idea of equality and so on. Choice, the mantra of neoliberalism, it got taken up very much in feminism. What I think we need to understand, for instance, is if it is a matter of choice that people do these things, how come so few men are interested in the delights that high heels and makeup could offer them and actually choosing that? The mantra of choice is used in terms of prostitution as well, for instance, which is an area I work in a lot. And I try to explain to people that actually men do not have a choice to enter prostitution in the way that women do. It is a gendered phenomenon. Men cannot, in short shorts be on the street corners in this city and get picked up by business women coming home from work in their cars and used in sexual acts. It doesn't work like that. It's not an equal opportunity industry. It's about the use of women predominantly for men. So it's the same thing with beauty practices. There's no equal choice there. Otherwise, of course, men would be choosing it unless we think that somehow brains are actually constructed around the possibility of choice, which, you know, makes no little sense. So choice is constructed by political reality and forces of power.
Okay, once again, I completely agree with you, and I think that... Oh, and one more thing. The problems, it's also, I mean, you've said this, but I also just want to make it explicit that one of the things that capitalism, as the Margaret Thatcher quote says, one of the things that capitalism wants for us to see ourselves as monads as opposed to members of a larger class.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, I mean, you were all just saying that, but it's something I think that can't be said often enough because it has become so... Because in many ways, unless you're a Marxist, class analysis has become extremely unpopular. A Marxist or radical feminist, I should say.
Yes, it certainly has. And radical feminism is very related to Marxism in as much as we understood from Marxism the way in which people were created into different classes by economic oppression, and we were able to relate that to the way in which men oppress women. It would have been difficult to do that if we hadn't had that understanding and that inspiration in the beginning. But yes, those ideas that there are any actual class or caste divisions in society has really been very much attacked. And of course, at the present, when more and more people are becoming poorer and poorer, and we've got the creation of a precariat and class divisions that people have been happy about, you know, thinking they were able to be middle class in America when that security is disappearing. All of that is actually collapsing to the creation of a much more unequal society at the same time as people are imagining that they're responsible for their own fate, they're only individuals, nothing is going on, there are no forces of power. There's an extraordinary contrast between those things that are happening at the moment, it's fair to say.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you've mentioned prostitution a couple times, and so I guess this would be a good time to sort of segue into talking a little bit about the industrial vagina, and that's
mm-hmm.
that's an extraordinarily evocative title. And those are, you know, obviously industrial and vagina are two words that should never be combined. So, can you talk about what that means?
Yes, I chose that title very deliberately because there was some kind of idea, that's common idea, that prostitution is simply sex work. It's about sex, that it's a perfectly reasonable thing to use women sexually, to use their vagina for men's sexual excitement, and that there's no harms in it, and that's perfectly okay. Now, what I was seeking to do in the title is, first of all, say that actually women's bodies are not machines. That it's painful and harmful to women to use their bodies in that way. Vaginas are simply not used, are simply not suited to this. Women have to use local anesthetic in their vaginas, as they do in this city. The Occupational Health and Safety Code say women should be careful using a local anesthetic in the vagina because it can hide more serious injuries. Women bleed. Women experience very considerable pain. So women's bodies are not machines. So I actually wanted to put those two words together to show how unsuitable that was, because what has happened in the prostitution industry, the massive prostitution industry that's become such an important part of the economies both of countries like Australia and Thailand and so on, that depends upon using women's bodies as if they are machines and using women as if they are objects. Also, I used the term industrialization because I wanted to show how the industry has taken off, so that though many people may be under the misunderstanding that prostitution is still as once it was, perhaps, which is individual women working on the street because that's more convenient for their lifestyle or whatever. I sought in that title to show that it is a massive industry which is industrialized. It's organized now in the sense in which industrialization was a period in history in which work was moved out of the home and into factories, and therefore the workers involved in that lost a lot of their ability to control their own lives and became pawns for bigger industries. So, of course, prostitution has worked in that way. We have huge brothels like the Daily Planet in this city, which has, you know, over 100 women working there, and dormitories at the top of the brothels for the women who are traveling through to stay in whilst they're being used in the brothels and so on. We've got a massive sex industry now, which is organized, and the profits go to others. I mean, the average wages of women in prostitution in Australia a few years ago were reckoned to be about $29,000 a year, and in Canada about $27,000. These are not high wages. The women in the brothels, and we're talking about the brothels here in Australia certainly, are not getting the profits. So industrialists are setting up industrialized forms of prostitution in massive strip clubs, massive brothels, and massive industries online and escort services and so on, where they're making huge amounts of money off the bodies and the pain of the women who are in the industry, and they're making international industries out of this as well, of course, because there's a globalization of the sex industry going on. But also that industry is now being seen as an important sector of the economy for governments because it's such a powerful part of the economy. From estimates that in Thailand it was responsible for 14% of the GDP, to China about 8%, to South Korea about 4%, and so on. But we're talking about substantial sectors of the economy that governments are concerned to nurture and promote because they make very large amounts of money for those economies. And prostitution has not been seen in that way. Those who defend prostitution say that it's a job like any other, it empowers women, it's about choice, as if women were somehow independent workers. We're not encouraged to think about the industry, who is really making the profit, what it does to women, and so on. So that's really what the title was about.
Okay, once again, I completely agree with you on this, and can you just make really explicit what's wrong with everything you just said? I mean, what's wrong with the fact that it's industrialized? What's wrong with the fact that women are used in this way? I just want you to be really explicit.
Yes.
Here's the
country of Australia. In Australia, prostitution is legalized in most of the states here. So there are legal brothels which can get licenses from the state governments to operate. What actually happens in prostitution, I call prostitution a form of violence against women, an under-recognized form of violence against women. And if you look at the occupational health and safety codes, which are constructed between the state governments and often sex work organizations, when they legalize prostitution, they like to have a health and safety code to make it look as if it's all above board. When you look at them, it becomes clear what the harms are in terms of the harms to individual women and the fact that it is a practice of violence. I'm talking here about both the paid-for violence of prostitution and the unpaid-for violence. The unpaid-for violence in prostitution is the fact that women are regularly subject to rape and assault, which is not anything that they get paid for, but is an ordinary, regular part of the job. So, for instance, in my city, there are safety tips for escort workers. Those are the women who are sent out to men's cars, to hotel rooms, to houses. And in the safety tips, which are on the South Melbourne Community Health website, in other words, you know, an ordinary state website, it says that women approaching a house to which they've been sent for the purposes of prostitution should work out how many cars there are around the house. If there are too many cars, it means that they will be gang raped. And fascinatingly, there's very similar health and safety codes, supposedly, or advice, let us say, in countries in Asia about women in prostitution. You get the same advice in Thailand and so on. So prostitution doesn't vary much in the sense that the gang rape is a serious threat. As women approach, they're told to park around the corner so the man cannot see the car and will assume they have a driver. so that there will be someone who could potentially protect them. But the women are told in the same health and safety code that if they have a driver, he may also try to rape them and try to get sex off them. So it isn't safe to have one, and it will cost them a lot of their earnings to employ a driver. When they go to the front door, they are told they should say to the man, this is a really interesting house, can you show me around? It's probably a very unpleasant, smelly and not very nice house. But they're told they need to check where the exits are because they may need to run out. They are told that they need to leave their belongings, their handbag, clothes, near the door so that if they have to run out, they can pick those up and don't have to run out completely naked. They are told that if the man is... starts to be difficult towards them, I'm sorry, my cat is saying things into the phone as well, we'll have to deal with that, then they should pick up a large glass ashtray and smash the man's stereo or throw the ashtray through the window. He'll be upset about his stereo or a neighbor might notice if they throw the ashtray through the window and so on. So we know that prostitution is enormously dangerous and harmful to women because, of course, women in prostitution are seen as, they are seen as sort of the lowest grouping of women, the women who it's most reasonable for men to be violent against men. It can be violent against any women, particularly often, though, they target the women in prostitution. So it's terribly dangerous. What's extraordinary is that a state government should think it reasonable to even offer advice like this. You can't imagine it being offered to men who are working on a construction site, for instance. Then in terms of the ordinary violence of prostitution that is paid for, as I mentioned before, women are told that they should be careful with the local anesthetic in the vagina because it can harm more serious injuries. They are told that they have to be careful about condom use because, of course, they are expected to cause the men to use condoms, but the men do not wish to. And, in fact, Swiggers have suggested that 40% of men in Melbourne using women in prostitution do not or have not used condoms. So the women are told that they need to reach behind themselves without the man noticing, to check whether a condom is still on his penis by, you know, sort of feeling the penis, because they mustn't let him know that they're doing that, but the implication being, of course, that he will beat them up if he does know. So obviously there's a very problematic situation here, which doesn't apply to any other jobs. The extraordinary thing is that often the propagandists of prostitution say it is an ordinary job, and in this country we've had men say that prostitution is actually like, you know, law or medicine and so on. And in law and medicine, women are not forced to become naked behind closed doors in the presence of a man in a situation where it is so dangerous. Now, in the ordinary course of a booking, the man will twist a woman's nipples. He will thrust his fingers up her anus to show that he wants to do anal sex. The anal sex is very painful in itself. A woman in prostitution in Melbourne said it was like having a red-hot poker up straight up through the center of her body. The occupational health and safety codes in Queensland say things like they've got something called negotiating a difficult booking. It says that if you're very sore because you've got very painful genitals from having too many men using you during the day, and a man wants to fondle your genitals, you mustn't put him off. You can't put the man off or cause any difficulties because he'll lose his erection, he won't pay you, and the job doesn't get done. So you constantly have to keep the man sexually aroused. So you're supposed to say, no, I'd rather you fondled my breast. Actually, you hate that as well, and you'd like to be anywhere else but there, but that's what you have to say. Also, talking about dealing with difficult clients, that occupational health and safety code says that if the man is attacking you, it's important to leave, because even though you'll lose the booking and won't get the money, you don't want bruises upon your body because you won't be able to work the next day. So imagine a government saying to workers, get out if you're being hit because you don't want to have bruises on you the next day, which will mean you can't work. It's unthinkable that any other group of people supposedly in the workforce would be treated in this way. Ordinary office workers, for instance, are told be careful when you're putting more ink in the photocopier because there can be harmful substances in the ink and keep the window open. Now, put that on a scale with being told about condoms and sexually transmitted diseases, abortions, how to deal with pain. There isn't a comparison. Women in prostitution are treated as if they are really, really not fully human.
You know, I hate the fact that our discourse is so absurd in this culture that I even had to ask you that question. That's one of the things I find really, really horrible is the fact that I even had to ask you what's wrong with it. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that the reason that you have to ask it is because in this culture, as a result of the sex industry, the spread of pornography, the whole promotion of messages about sexuality, the portent of those messages are that women can be used in any way, that they are simply rags to be used, penetrated, used in any way, and that they will find all of that enormously exciting. So there's no consideration as women as human beings in relation to what sex is supposed to be about in this culture.
And there's a great quote that I would like to read by the writer and gay activist Arthur Evans. And this is one reason he thinks that BDSM, bondage and all that, is harmful. He says, "We have to reflect on the implications of what we do, both for ourselves and for the society at large. We have to do for sex and for every other aspect of our lives. We have to do so for sex and every other aspect of our lives. That's what it means to be a mature human being." So once again, it comes down to, this is not specifically about personal choice, but also what does it say about the society at large, and what is good for society at large? And I'm not talking about the economy. I'm talking about, you know, because obviously you're saying these are important. These are that prostitution is good for the economy in that sense. But that doesn't mean that it's good for society. And do we want to live in a society where women are treated like that, where women are treated as body parts?
But it's more than that. We say, or governments may think, that prostitution is good for the economy, but you have to work out what are the economic effects of treating a whole segment of the female population in this way. And there was a very good study done on the economic costs, the opportunity costs of women and girls being in prostitution in Canada, which looked at the fact that women and girls in prostitution enter very young. They're very likely to be sort of 14 to 17 years old, even in Western societies, particularly in the rest of the world. They do not finish education. They do not get any skills training. Once they're in prostitution, they have no CV because they have no jobs they can put on a CV. They don't discover any kind of skills or create any kind of skills apart from managing not to be in more pain than they could otherwise be. They are likely to be in prostitution for a limited amount of time because it's very, very difficult in terms of the toll on the body and the toll on the mind of being in that very abusive industry. In prostitution, they are likely to be using drugs or alcohol to get by, which takes a huge amount of their income. I think in this study it was found they'd have about 12% of their income left after paying pimps, after paying the places where they're prostituted, after paying for drugs and alcohol and so on. They're likely to be in for a short amount of time. After that, it's very hard to get back into the workforce, and they may have to pay, in America, for instance, healthcare costs for what's done to their reproductive system, to the psychological harms of prostitution. So that generation of women that's gone through prostitution are not going to be a part of the productive economy in the way that other people who have not been so subordinated would be able to be. So even economically, there are huge costs in treating swathes of the female population in this way. But if we leave aside those economic costs for a moment, what prostitution does to a society like Melbourne, where the brothels are legalized, for instance, is, first of all, there are huge costs on the community through the promotion of organized crime. Organized crime riddles and is hugely significant in prostitution, both strip clubs and brothels in this city. Bikie gangs are involved in prostitution and so on. So that creates a problem for community policing and public safety. There's problems, huge problems for women because, of course, women lose large parts of the city. It's difficult for women and children to feel safe walking in the parts of the city which have been given over to men for their sexual abuse of women, those areas that have got large numbers of brothels, strip clubs, and so on in. So women lose their ordinary equal civil rights to be able to walk in parts of the city. Women's status is hugely undermined in general because generations of children and young men are trained to think of women as simply being there to sexually service them. The sex of prostitution that's taught to men in prostitution is that a woman's body is simply a series of orifices to be used. It's nothing to do with her pleasure or her personhood. She doesn't even have to be there in her mind. She's simply indeed a collection of body parts. Pornography teaches that too, of course, and pornography is simply the visual representation of prostitution. All of that has an impact upon the sex that women are expected to do in ordinary relationships, so that in ordinary heterosexual relationships now, men are demanding anal sex, which is demanded in the brothels in this city. They're demanding to be able to ejaculate over women's faces and over their eyes, because that's the most effective way to rub out and extinguish the personhood of another human being. And for many men, that's a very exciting moment. That's the money shot, when that personhood is extinguished. So the practices of the sex industry in general are becoming what sex is for women. Now, we never imagined this would happen. Back in the 1970s, feminists like myself in Britain, in the women's movement, one of our demands was a self-defined sexuality for women. We thought we'd come to the point where women's sexual pleasure and sexual personhood could actually be considered, if not the center of what sex was about in heterosexual relationships. There is no possibility of that. Women's relationships with men are also undermined, because the men using women in prostitution, perfectly ordinary men, about 50% of whom are generally in long-term or married relationships with women, there's no equality in that relationship. If the woman knows what's happening, that is a constant threat to her. If she doesn't know, she's in a situation where she's living a lie. Many women do find out, of course, then have to leave those relationships. So the effect upon women in all of those ways means they cannot have equal relationships with men in heterosexuality, because prostitution teaches the complete opposite of that. But also it affects women's equality in the possibility of the professional and employment equality, because what's happening now more and more is that men network through prostitution, and women cannot have the same opportunities. For instance, professional people, lawyers and so on, males, take their clients to strip clubs and they go to brothels. They order in prostitutes for those men to get their business and so on. Women are in no position to do any of this. So women in commercial law or in sales are hugely disadvantaged by the use of others of their kind as pieces of trade between these men to network. If we want to understand how this happens politically and at a grander scale, we need to think, for instance, of Berlusconi, who used these parties where women were simply exchanged between men, so that men in powerful positions in the law, in business, in government can come together and use women in prostitution to form their bonds. If we think of how this works in high finance, of course, there's the Strauss-Kahn example, head of the IMF, who has been charged with being involved in the promotion of prostitution networks in France, at parties where all the significant men in that society came together to use prostitution together, very similar to Berlusconi. Berlusconi was apparently involved in helping Gaddafi, when he was still alive in North Africa, to realize his political ambitions by sending prostituted women over to him to be offering as presents and so on. So prostitution in the powerful networking of men is hugely important, and it's hugely important at the level of your ordinary company in America, where women in sales are in no position. Women are in no position to have equality if they're going to Asia, where prostitution is even more integrated into ordinary business dealings than it is in other places in the West. Women on business trips to Asia cannot be offered prostituted women in the same way as men on business trips, will automatically be directed towards the 14th floor of the hotel where the prostitution is available and so on. So prostitution, the sex industry, is a huge and enormous obstacle in the way of women having any kind of real equality. There's no possibility whatsoever of women having any kind of equality whilst a whole swathe of their kind is separated off and subjected to men's sexual violence in this way.
Well, thank you for that. And we're pretty close to out of time, so I'm wondering if you could... You've given so much really important information analysis, and if you could sum up in like 20 seconds, sorry. What do you want people to do with this information, that an analysis that you've given them?
Well, we've covered a lot of ground, but I think in terms of prostitution generally, certainly people need to understand that it is a practice of violence against women, and they need to work towards the Swedish model in prostitution policy, which punishes the men and decriminalizes the women and provides lots of services so that it's easy for the women to get out of prostitution. That will be crucial in relation to prostitution. In relation to beauty practices, well, you know, it's very hard to work against these huge industries, but it's important to try and fight the pressure upon women, whether it's in workplaces or anywhere else, to enforce these harmful practices against them.
Thank you so much, Sheila, and thank you for your work in general, and thank you for the conversation today, and thank you, listeners, for listening. This is Derek Jensen with Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.